I'm Professor Bob Hewish from the Department of International Development Studies at Dalhousie University. You're listening to GDP, the Global Development Primer, the podcast dedicated to all issues in international development studies. Follow me on Twitter at Professor Hewish. Welcome back to another episode of the Global Development Primer podcast. And for this episode, we are very happy to have a returning guest and a claimed fan favorite, Tari Ajadi, join us. Tari is a PhD candidate in political science at Dalhousie University. His dissertation research compares how Black activists in municipalities in Nova Scotia and in Ontario are strategizing to promote change in policing and in health policy. A British Nigerian immigrant to Canada, Tari aims to produce research that supports and engages with Black communities across the country. Tari has published articles in the Globe and Mail, the Chronicle Herald, University Affairs, Canadian Government Executive, Canadian Diversity, and TAI. He is a member of the Board of Directors of the Health Association of African Canadians. He is a junior fellow at the McEachern Institute of Public Policy and Governance, and he holds a master's in political science from Dalhousie University. And once again, one of our favorite guests to always have on the Global Development Primer, Tari Ajadi. Welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me back again.
Oh man, this is always a pleasure. And I know the last couple times we've had you by the podcast, we asked you to talk about, you know, theories and things that were in textbooks, and you did such a good job of animating them that figured now is the time to talk about Tari Ajadi. What is the work that he's doing? Right. And I think it's something that folks within development circles are going to be very interested in. I know that you're doing a lot of work in North America but yeah, right. But it is going to be a topic that will have importance in international development discussions. And that is the concept of defunding police. This is something we've heard quite a bit from activist circles in the US and in Canada as well. This is your research, Tari. What does it mean to defund police?
Defunding. So yes, as you mentioned, thanks so much for that introduction. Right. Defunding is my research to some extent. It's also something that I'm actively involved in kind of thinking through, conceptualizing, and, you know, moving forward within in my present context, which is here in Halifax, Nova Scotia. So what does defunding mean? Unfortunately, a lot of folks don't really know. And that, in fact, the reasons why in Halifax, Nova Scotia, the Municipal Board of Police Commissioners actually have initiated a process explicitly to define defunding the police. And that's just one indication of the lack of kind of knowledge about this particular concept, this particular frame that has in many ways shaped a lot of political discourse over the past 12 to 18 months. So there is a pretty clear definition, but unfortunately, you know, a lot of folks have taken particular tangents of this definition or particular aspects and have inflated it or downgraded it to a point where it doesn't really make much sense to anybody.
Well, this is it. Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking here, so as a volunteer firefighter, if I was to hear that they were defunding the fire department, I could tell you exactly what that would look like. That would be, you know, fewer career guys working on the trucks, probably fewer engines, probably a lot more private fundraising. I'm guessing this isn't what you're referring to when we're talking about defunding the police.
No. So one of the first misconceptions is the idea that defunding is about austerity. In fact, it emerges out of a long and robust tradition of activists trying to get more investment into broader social services and community-based services that look towards community well-being and community safety. And so the idea of defunding is really about looking at the police as an agency of municipalities, though in Canada, at various points, the police are also an agency of the federal government. But let's stick to cities for a moment here. It's looking at police as an agency that municipal governments fund and looking at the many other ways that municipal governments can impact or integrate with community safety, and looking at the massive imbalance between the amount of money that the police services in various municipalities are given, and the amount of money that various community services, whether those are homeless shelters, whether those are community-based health programs, whether those are harm reduction sites for use of drugs. There's a significant difference between the amount of money that the police get and the amount of money that those various services get. And there's very little indication in a lot of respects that suggests that the present form of policing in many municipalities, and we'll get into that in one second, but the present form of policing in municipalities actually meaningfully contributes to community safety at the rate that would justify the significant overrepresentation in municipal budgets. And so what these activists are suggesting is, listen, why don't we take the funding that's currently being given to police forces and therefore some of the responsibilities given to them, take that funding, let's put it into community services that are civilianized and that directly address some of the many issues that are presupposed at being at the root of crime. Homelessness, poverty, right? Drug usage, mental health crises, things of that nature. Let's invest more specifically into solutions that can help support people who are going through some of these challenges. And let's not use the police as the catch-all organization that governs the way that community safety is conducted.
So really, thank you for that, Tari. If anyone's listened to that and they've had questions about what defunding the police is, you've just answered it very well. Like, it's to me, it sounds like it's almost a movement then to get police services looking more upstream. And before they're going to these downstream events of having to do hard arrests and scenarios that then will always go before the courts, as opposed to more of not sorry, surveillance per se, but community engagement. And dare I say, this is not the first time in history that police forces have entertained these ideas. And I'm thinking to New York City, in the late 80s, early 90s, I believe, had a program that was about community engagement. And even in the early days of the London Police, Robert Peel's idea was that there should be community engagement with policing. It shouldn't be a paramilitary organization who just serves arrest warrants when needed.
Well, that's precisely it. So there's a few different aspects to this. Firstly, as you mentioned, the Peelian principles of policing are really the kind of bedrock for the kinds of urban policing that we see in municipalities across much of the world, certainly in the former British colonies and to some extent in the Americas as well. And so the idea is that the police are supposed to be the public and the public are supposed to be the police. In other words, you cannot have police officers or police forces that are separate from their broader communities and said they should engage in their communities, they should quote unquote walk the beat, they should be accountable to their communities, etc. And this is in broad contrast to the kind of paramilitary or imperial model of policing, which actually is very much the model that the RCMP in Canada was founded on and based upon. But we could get into that another day. I love talking about some of the broader historical important narrative. But, you know, for the interest of time, I'm just going to focus in very narrowly on this particular Peelian formulation of policing. So this is the kind of golden standard. It's the way that the Metropolitan Police in London were formed, and police forces across much of the world kind of continued on in a similar vein. But when we think about what police forces actually do on a day-to-day basis, and when we think about the ways that they relate to communities, particularly communities that are marginalized, racialized communities, and when I say racialized, in many municipalities, I'm speaking very specifically about Black people and about Indigenous peoples. Mm-hmm. When the ways that they're treated and the ways that they engage with police forces don't match that vision of Peelian policing at all. And so what ends up happening is that oftentimes the relationships between various community members and the police is conflictual. It's often very much in practice a command and control model, where in fact what we do see is a lot of surveillance of these communities. What we do see is a lack of meaningful engagement. What we do see is a massive disproportionality in terms of contact, in terms of various forms of racial profiling that might include police stops, that might include street checks, that might include various other forms, fines, things of that nature that might occur as a result of increased contact with the police. And what that does is it in effect harms community safety by putting these individuals and their communities in a state of constant stress and constant fear of the police. Now, for those who believe in defunding, there is in and of itself a separation. There are some folks that believe that defunding needs to lead to complete abolition of police forces. They presuppose and suggest that police forces, particularly in North America, are founded upon irreparable forms of racial harm, and that that model, as presently constituted, should not exist. And instead, what we can do is develop new ways of relating to each other in communities, new ways of keeping each other safe. There are other folks who are in this debate who very much exist within a form of saying policing as an institution isn't inherently unfixable, but what we need to do is take away some of the many tasks that police officers have and civilianize some of those tasks, with the understanding that when we ask police officers to also be social workers, when we ask police officers to be outreach for folks who use drugs, when we ask police officers to take on all of these different roles, they're not equipped and they're not trained to do any of these things. And so what they default to oftentimes is violence. Now, that debate in and of itself holds a lot of complexities, and as opposed to positioning those as diametrically opposed models, instead what we might think of as a spectrum of approaches, a spectrum of understandings about what defunding means and what the end goal might be.
So with that, the language though is still defunding, and what I'm thinking about is where a lot of police budgets tend to go. And a lot of the very expensive things are involved with kind of the responsive hardware, the enforcement side of things,
right.
new equipment, new mechanisms to try to find more innovative forms of arrest. And I'm thinking particularly, holy smokes, you want to roll it back a whole decade to the G20 in Toronto,
right?
Was announced that. What do they spend $125 million in 3 days on police budget?
Yeah, it was something outrageous like that.
I think it was up there like that. Like it was $125 million for 3 days, not including the prep and the lead up as well.
Yeah.
And it was heralded as the largest police expenditure in Canadian history at the time. And I'm thinking to myself, that's a lot of money to put on protesters who were, you know, disagreeing with globalization trade frameworks at the time. How much money is the RCMP putting into, or the police forces across the country, into surveillance and pursuing Hell's Angels and active criminal organizations in the country? Like, to say that that's the most money they've ever spent on something, that's concerning.
You know? Right. Well,
there's a lot of other things that were those dollars should be defunded from and then put into else.
Well, that's precisely it. I mean, we can take a little run through here, and I don't mean to single them out. So, you know, I suppose I ought to apologize, though, you know, if anyone has ever seen any of my submissions to Halifax City Council in the past, they'd know that, you know, this isn't quite rare for me. But as a case in point, the Halifax Regional Police spend somewhere in the range of $250,000 to $300,000 every single year on the use of polygraph testing on their own employees. Polygraph testing is not admissible in a court of law, except for as a form of deception. So you can trick someone into believing that the polygraph testing will actually be used, and they might end up confessing a particular kind of crime, and then therefore, ipso facto, you can use a polygraph test. But the actual results of polygraph testing have been ruled by the Supreme Court of Canada to not be useful and not be helpful because, you know, they're highly unreliable. I mean, if you have a heart arrhythmia, all of a sudden you're a liar, right? Like, that doesn't really make much sense. But we're spending $300,000 on polygraph testing. Victim services in the Halifax Regional Municipality, particularly for victims of sexual assault and sexual violence, domestic violence, has a smaller budget than polygraph testing, right? So when advocates and activists are thinking about defunding, they're looking specifically at the ways that police forces choose to use their money with very little oversight. And this is the other side of the coin here, right? Whether we're thinking about purchases of hardware, like military-grade weapons and rifles and buggies and things of that nature, these tactical advantages to roam the streets of Winnipeg and look for, I don't know, insurgents, I suppose, right? Whether we're thinking about those kinds of expenditures, or we're thinking about, you know, the rampant use of massive overtime to inflate police budgets, the oversight for police forces is minimal. So municipalities are supposed to have police oversight boards, and oftentimes they're composed in part of municipal councillors. Oftentimes they also have other civilians on them. But ostensibly, they're supposed to hold police forces to account. In practice, what ends up happening is they end up rubber stamping every single budget that police officers put in front of them, to a point where sometimes they're like, well, actually, you need more money than you're asking for. Let's give you more money. Meanwhile, you know, libraries are going without various kinds of funding, and certainly other initiatives within cities are often operating on shoestring budgets when we think about not-for-profits and other things, right? So it's not just about the actual dollars and cents, but it's about a mentality where police can do no wrong, and where their budgets must ever expand because the police equals safety. And so when we talk about defunding, what we're doing is disrupting this very narrow conception of safety and thinking about it in a far more broad manner.
So really, this comes back down to it. Your research, Centauri, is, the way I'm hearing it, much more to do with public health than it is to do with anything.
Yeah.
Regarding criminality studies.
Yeah, well, that's it. I came to this through public health. What I realized in doing my research, and also just engaging with folks in communities, one of the biggest risks to the health, particularly of people of African descent, is the constant stress and strain of perceived discrimination, right? It affects blood pressure, it affects sleep, it affects eating habits, it affects all different kinds of mechanisms that support the health of a particular community and of a particular individual.
I can just chime in with my mm-hmm. geography background on that. There's a whole field of study that is dedicated to understanding healthy cities and healthy landscapes, and how landscapes in place do create experiences of health, not just in terms of are you contracting illness, but the broader definition of the social determinants of health and well-being and your ability to essentially be resilient.
Yeah.
And in conversations that I've had with you and I've heard you have with others, the point is very clear, is that when a person of African descent leaves their home and goes into these cities, into the public space, that whole landscape is completely different than a person of white descent.
Yes.
And any sort of nod or discussion about the healthiness of a landscape of a city suddenly gets inverted, flipped, and distorted based on race, just as somebody leaves their home.
Yep, that's precisely it, right? Like, and we've got to think about the role that the police play in that particular dynamic. If you're living in a community that is heavily surveilled by the police, if you're living in a community that is branded by others within your particular broader municipality as unsafe, as dangerous, as full of quote-unquote gang activity, et cetera, well, then you're always going to be stressed. And that police presence may or may not contribute to the reduction of crime in that particular space. I mean, there's various different ways that one might think about reducing crime, but correlation does not always necessarily mean causation. And certainly in a lot of places across Canada, increased police presence has not necessarily corresponded to a reduction in crime. Crime has actually reduced whether or not the police presence has gone up or gone down, right? So that shows you that there's a relative delinking between the amount of police officers in a particular jurisdiction and the crime severity rate as calculated by Statistics Canada. And yet the presence of a particular group of people, i.e. the police, who very often perceive you specifically as a threat, creates a form of stress. It makes the space that you're living in feel unwelcome. It makes you feel as if you are a target. And that stress in and of itself is contributing to a whole host of harms in terms of the health of people of African descent.
You know, this is brilliant, the way you're describing this. I mean, there's so much that can be explored in terms of how stress, and what you're referring to as specifically distress, you know, not the sort of eustress where you feel like, oh, that was a hard marathon I ran, but I feel great now that I finished. It's this constant bombardment of reinforcing negativity. And as much as it has that impact on personal, on an individual, it ripples. In fact, it tears through family and community dynamics harder than anything else. And that can't be good for anyone or anything.
Well, that's it. It's really not good. And I think that the impact of profound kind of surveillance, of being stopped again and again by the police, of potentially facing active police violence, is not merely felt amongst the people that are acutely experiencing this, but it's felt throughout the broader community. It's felt throughout various families who may have had a loved one who's been imprisoned or a loved one who's been brutalized by the police, right? Like this really echoes throughout communities, and it echoes throughout what we call the life course, right? It affects the trajectory of one's life and the health that one might experience throughout their lives, right? And so this is where I, you know, for me, it becomes something that is so important, thinking about how we can make our communities safe places for all of us in ways that don't presume this kind of domination and this kind of, in my view, oppression for particular racialized communities.
So, Tari, two terms that, if I could just ask you how they impact the stress. One is the spot checking, right?
Street checks.
That's the first one. Could you tell us about that?
Right. So street checks, you know, the street checks being a broad umbrella for particular stops that police might orchestrate on a particular person or a particular group of people to get identifying information from them. Sometimes it's actually being stopped. Other times it's literally being surveilled. And they're not necessarily doing anything wrong. But the police officer presumes that for whatever reason, they need to collect this identifying information for use somewhere down the line. And so street checks are a practice that once upon a time were broadly used across the country. Various different municipalities, including Halifax, have gotten rid of street checks, though, you know, whether they're actually gone or not is the subject of some considerable debate. But the point is that we're looking at this person or this group of people and suggesting that, like, there's something about them as police officers that triggers this idea that they are dangerous, that they might be committing a crime. And of course, what we've seen when we've looked at the data after street checks is a massive disproportionality about who is being street checked. And so, case in point, in Halifax, black people, I believe, were 6 times more likely to be street checked than white Haligonians. And so what that means is, well, who's perceived to be suspicious? It's very clear, right? Who we have the information about. And so whether that street check is active contact or whether it's passive, whether it's someone sitting in a car and noting down things, that affects someone's perception of stress. Of course, if a police officer stops you and asks you for a bunch of information, doesn't tell you what your rights are, and doesn't tell you why they're asking, that sounds pretty stressful to me, right? And I think it would be stressful to most of us. But also, an ambient sense of being watched it's a really horrible feeling. I don't know if it's ever happened to you or certainly to any of our listeners listening to the podcast, but it's really not a very nice feeling. And it certainly contributes to a form of stress that people may face.
Thank you for that, Tari. And the second definition, if you can comment on response times.
Right. So when we're thinking about response times, what we're really thinking about is the ways that particular agencies, so it's not just the police forces here, it's also ambulances and also the fire department, fire department. Those beautiful red trucks. How quickly do they respond to a 911 call, a call of distress, right? And so, you know, for certainly ambulances, for fire departments, there are particular metrics for when they ought to meet those particular thresholds, right? And then for police forces, they also have those metrics, but sometimes in different neighborhoods, those metrics may slip a little bit. And so when there's an actual call for distress, maybe they might not be so quick to actually arrive at a particular place. Or maybe they might arrive at the place, but maybe the action that's taken might not necessarily be the action that the person who called, looking for support with, I don't know, their relative that's having a mental health crisis might seek out. And so, unfortunately and tragically, that has happened quite a bit in Canada of late, which is where we get this idea of wellness checks, where police officers are called because there's a distressed person with mental health challenges. They end up arriving at the particular place where that person is, and for various reasons, at various points in time in the past year, there have been several people that have died as a result of these wellness checks. Now, the actual liability here, I won't say, and I'm not going to commit slander by attributing blame on this podcast, but I will say that they're police involved. Police officers are somehow involved in these things. And so that, again, contributes to a form of stress and a form of perception of, well, we don't want to call these people because certain things might end up happening that we don't want them to happen if they arrive at all.
Right. And it's stories, again, to not cite our sources too heavily, but to know that there's some neighborhoods where there's active surveillance going on. Officers are there surveying the neighborhood. There is an emergency that takes place. And you literally got officers right there who will not break cover in order to respond to the emergency, even though they know it's happening. And so now it seems that, you know, the other angle to this is that there are some neighborhoods where the police department will be there in 3 minutes or less. And others where it might be about a good 20 minutes before they show up.
Yeah.
Those neighborhoods may be the ones that actually have a phenomenal volume of police presence in them, just not responding to calls in that way.
Right. That's precisely it. And it, again, it's all about questioning, well, if there's an increased police presence, what for and to what end? Who's being served by this?
It seems, Terry, that the more that the budgets get passed annually to build infrastructure and then to create, let me get this right, SOPs and SOGs, those are standard operating procedures and standard operating guidelines based on the equipment that's available and based on the tactics that are being brought in. If it's this reactionary downstream approach, you know, it's a market for an endless budget. It's this marketability to say there's always going to be more need because in a sense, you're creating that need.
That's precisely it. And I think that it's something that we see again and again when you look at the justifications that police chiefs and police unions use to justify why police budgets need to be maintained or need to be increased. They'll say that, oh, our services are stretched. They'll say that, you know, crime rates are increasing oftentimes without necessarily that being explicitly the case, or they'll say that the reason why they need increased budgets is because crime rates are decreasing, therefore that shows that in fact it's effective to have a higher budget in order to make sure that the crime rates continue to decrease, right? So in other words, there's always a justification as to why the budget needs to be increased. There's never really a question of like, well, is this actually the right approach, or maybe we need to right size this a little bit?
Yeah, and ultimately someone has to sit there writing that check. And, you know, someone who's just panting with bated breath, just waiting to sign on the dotted line to give that money over. You know, there's a lot of people in the private sector who benefit from that as well.
Right? Absolutely.
They're going to be buying vehicles, weapons, gear, private training, you name it. So, Tari, a couple more questions just for you.
Yeah.
And I guess the one I'm thinking of is, are there examples today internationally where you've seen discussions like this go in that direction of seeing police forces reapproach themselves to look at these upstream determinants of health? We mentioned the early Peel, we mentioned New York City, you know, 30 years ago. Anything going on today in the world?
Oh, yes. So there's quite a lot. This has become, in fact, a governing question for a lot of municipalities across North America in specific, to some extent the United Kingdom as well, though they're faced with many other challenges as it relates to police forces. And so the discourse hasn't quite been the same. I think that one of the things that happens with defunding is a particular understanding of defunding is linked to particularly gun violence. And so the United Kingdom doesn't have as much gun violence, and so the presence of police forces is perceived to be a little bit less intimidating, not of course for black folks or other people of color in the United Kingdom, but certainly as part of a kind of mainstream thought process. So the discourse hasn't taken root to the same extent in the United Kingdom as it has in the United States. But certainly we can look at Minneapolis, the site where George Floyd was murdered by the police officer Derek Chauvin last year. They had a very strong look at defunding the police, and those efforts largely fell apart after a lot of wrangling within their municipality. We can look at cities like Austin, Texas, and Portland, Oregon, that have looked at it. Again, New York City ended up covering off a lot of their COVID costs by taking money away from their police force and putting it into essentially covering some of their debts. And in fact, as has been found in quite a few of these cities, crime rates went down. And in some of the cities that have talked about defunding or have issued defunding, crime rates have gone up. In other words, crime rates aren't really linked to defunding at all. It appears that they're linked to broader social factors, including, I don't know, the two-year-long pandemic that we're currently going through, right? Mm-hmm. But in Canada as well, cities like Edmonton have looked at defunding the police. They've issued reports and have taken some money away. And in Halifax, this is an ongoing debate, and it's a debate that I'm very actively involved in as well. Now, when we think internationally outside of the North American context, one of the interesting things is that the defunding discourse in specific hasn't really been taken up, because the funding of police forces hasn't necessarily been that great, particularly in the context of the developing world, quote unquote, whatever we mean by that very broad and very kind of specious framework of thinking about international spaces and relations. Right. So what we could see as defunding might also come up in other forms. So if I think about Nigeria and I think about the end SARS protests, that's in some ways related to the concept of defunding, right? And so the end SARS protests were about a particular almost military-like team as part of policing in Nigeria that would find young people primarily, people that appeared to have wealth and status, and accused them essentially of being armed robbers, and commit some atrocities that are not particularly dissimilar from the atrocities that are committed against Black and Indigenous folks here in Canada, and Black folks, Native American folks, Hispanic folks, and other people of color in the United States. So, you know, there were widespread protests to kind of disrupt this particular logic. Those protests ended up becoming a far more complex set of factors due to a whole bunch of other factors in Nigeria. They were partially successful. They were also partially co-opted by other somewhat restive agents within the state. And it's unraveled into another form of conflagration in that particular jurisdiction. But in other words, defunding doesn't always look like the explicit discourse of defunding. What it really looks like is a pushback against state repression, state overreach. And I think that is happening in many jurisdictions around the world.
Great point. Tari, my last question for you is, it is election season in Canada. and it will be election season again in other parts of the world. Would you anticipate any parties running on a defunding the police platform and successfully get seats as a result of it?
Nope. I don't think that it has any hope that many mainstream parties are going to take up this discourse at all, in fact. And I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
I think that firstly, taking it again to a North American context, policing is largely a municipal venture or avenue. And so what that means is if federal politicians don't have to touch a politically contentious topic, they will avoid it like the plague. So I think that's one reason why you won't see politicians at a national level running on a defund platform, because it doesn't necessarily benefit them. But also, I do think that, as I mentioned, the massively divided discourse as it relates to defunding and the misconceptions and the miscasting of what defunding seeks to do and why it's happening are toxic for many politicians, right? And so what I think instead, the prospects for defunding are, again, as I mentioned, on a local level. I think that it's going to be people looking at their communities and saying, we need to do something different, and working within those particular municipalities, within those organizations, building movements, building an understanding of what this means, and making something happen. I don't think it's going to happen on a national scale. I mean, for goodness sake, we have federal politicians in Canada who are making controversial statements with Willy Wonka cartoons. I don't think that a topic as nuanced as defunding the police has much hope of getting any kind of fair hearing or fair say on
a national level. I'm with you on that. I don't anticipate seeing any election signs or commercials that make that claim. But yet there are parties who enter elections promising or promoting some of the health benefits that you and I discussed. And it's usually a bit of pie in the sky. Everyone thinks that they want to have healthier cities and healthier communities and more racial equity. And when the rubber hits the road, it never really does. Nope. And yet here's a very tangible example that cities, like you say, municipalities, with support from states or provinces and the federal levels, could really get after and maybe make some very concrete changes in an important way. But like you say, it's not something that anyone is going to articulate a platform on using that language.
I really don't think so. And again, you know, this is where the reception of particular political discourses is really important. So it's not just about what's being said, but how it's being said and also who's saying it. So who was behind the push to defund the police? Well, very often it's been the very people who have been marginalized and brutalized by the police. And if those people had a great degree of political sway and political say, well, then they probably wouldn't be in that situation in the first place, right? Mm-hmm. So in other words, it's a self-reinforcing prophecy as it relates to the forms of politics that we currently experience, certainly in North America, in Europe, and in many places as well, where oftentimes the most marginalized and the most brutalized by a particular form of politics are the people that oftentimes have the least say in formal political arenas. And so where I'm interested, where my research comes in, is how do we build power within informal political arenas such that we can sway politicians in the ways, in the strategic ways that they need to be swayed, in the spaces where they need to be convinced.
And that, Tari Jadi, is what we're waiting for you to write that thesis so we can get going on that. Thank you so much for explaining these terms in a way that hopefully enriches people's understanding of what we're really discussing here when we mention defunding police. And thank you again for your own perspective that is informed, personal, and engaging. It's always a pleasure.
It's always a pleasure to be on here. I'll be back anytime you'll have me. Thanks.
I think that's it. We've got we've been chatting with Tari Jadi, who is a PhD candidate in political science at Dalhousie University, a junior fellow at the McEachern Institute for Public Policy, and who will be a future guest once again on GDP. Thanks, Tari.
Thank you.